Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. There's been a lot of talk lately about the late American composer John Cage, one of the major figures of the 20th century avant-garde. Cage is on people's minds because his 100th birthday occurred on September 5th. But John Cage didn't materialize out of thin air. He found inspiration and support in the work of another composer, Henry Cowell. In fact, several generations of America's most important composers owe a musical and perhaps philosophical debt to Henry Cowell. But his career was marred by a morals charge that landed him in prison for 4 years. And today, people who at least know the names of John Cage or Aaron Copland or Charles Ives have no idea who Cowell was. Author and conductor Joel Sachs aims to fix that with his book, Henry Cowell, A Man Made of Music. Joel, welcome back.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
So John Cage didn't materialize out of thin air, but Henry Cowell seems to.
Yes.
Where did this guy come from?
Curious way in which he didn't materialize out of thin air. His parents were philosophical anarchists who settled in California in the 1890s, and that's where Henry was born in 1897.
So he is very much a 20th century figure.
Yes, absolutely.
And when we think of 20th century classical music, most people think of a very kind of bristling modernist style. Henry Cowell was one of the first to be like throwing forearms on the piano keys and stuff like that.
Yeah, he invented a lot of stuff, that's for sure. And he started using his arms to play large groups of notes because he wanted to hear those notes, and that's the only way you could do them. He claimed that the tone cluster originated with his attempt to imitate the sound of the surf. In California.
So, I mean, this guy who is, you know, seen in retrospect as a beacon of early modernism actually was trying to evoke the sounds of nature, and it seems, in a lot of these piano pieces, his own Celtic, Gaelic heritage.
Yes, although that changed a bit later into a different form, but what is reflected in these piano pieces is largely the legends that he knew from his father, and especially from a theosophist called John Varian, who, at a time when Gaelic was still illegal in Ireland, undertook to translate. He'd moved to the United States also. He undertook to translate into English the great Irish myths. But much later, Cowell got to know Irish folk music in Ireland, and that changed his view toward a more purely musical attempt to connect with the Irish heritage.
We're speaking with Joel Sachs about his book, Henry Cowell, A Man Made of Music. The piece Fairy Answer, this is from a recording that you did at the piano.
Right.
Is this one of those sort of Gaelic-tinged pieces?
Oh, yes, very much. There's a little legend that goes with it that you sing into this valley and there's a fairy who answers you, but the fairy doesn't answer quite the way that you did it. And so he has these wonderful phrases that are played entirely on the inside of the piano. They're quite conventional in some ways, except they never replicate themselves the same way.
The piece is by Henry Cowell. It's called Fairy Answer. That is music from Henry Cowell, 20th century American composer. And if you've never heard of him, well, my guest Joel Sachs, who you just heard at the piano doing that piece called Fairy Answer, aims to change that with his book, Henry Cowell, A Man Made of Music, because Cowell was a pivotal figure in the development of 20th century American classical music. And Joel, he seems to have been a man of contradictions. We've already talked about, you know, this modernist who also loved his Celtic roots. But he didn't have more than a grade school education, and yet he was a very literate person from a very literate family. He was married, but he was also gay. I mean, he seems to have just, like, set himself a very hard course, you know, throughout
well,
his life.
I think, John, that the reality is that if you invented a figure like Henry Cowell for a novel, no one would ever believe it was possible. It's true that he was very modernist, but he began to change in the, put it this way, as people heard in The Fairy Answer, musically it's a very lyric piece, mm-hmm. although mm-hmm. the techniques are very odd. And that is usually true of him, even in some of the strangest of these early modernist piano pieces. But things changed in the fall of 1929 when the Depression hit, when the stock market crashed, and then later when the bank run came. His career as a pianist really collapsed because there was no money around for concerts. In the Depression, of course, it was a terrible situation, and a bunch of the modernist composers all went quite left politically, including Cowell, and had regular meetings of the so-called Composers Collective, which he helped to found, to talk about...
And which included people like Aaron Copland.
Yeah, exactly. And the subject really was, how can you write music that the large mass of people can connect with? Were our modernist experiments great, but now do we have to move on? And that it changed his whole style of composing. Mm. Many people thought he was ruined by the prison term. Others think he sold out. But it really was this view of melody.
All right. I want to come back to the prison thing because that is a kind of a key part of the story of Henry Cowell. But first, you know, we started hearing a lot about world music in the 1980s, and in the 90s it became a big thing, and now it's just like part and parcel of our musical diet. For this guy in the 1920s to be listening to Japanese shakuhachi music and Indian ragas and Iranian classical music, how did that happen?
Oh, well, that was very interesting. His father left his mother, and she decided to move up. Well, in fact, it may even have happened when they were still together because there were a couple of periods when they lived in San Francisco on the edge of the Asian neighborhood. And all his pals were Asian kids and South Pacific kids, and they sang their songs, and he sang his Irish songs. And he got to know some guys who were political refugees from India who improvised, he said, were really amazing. And they let him sit in the corner. He was, at the time, I don't know how old because it's not clear, but somewhere between 8 and 10, probably.
So a formative years.
Formative years. Yeah. And he said, many years later, nobody ever told me that Western music was supposed to be better than all of this. Mm-hmm. So I grew up thinking all music was equally wonderful.
So the clip we're going to hear now is from a Henry Cowell piece called Homage to Iran. When did he write this piece?
He wrote this piece in the late 50s, and it was the result of his spending several months in Iran on a government contract to try to upgrade music on Iranian radio. And there were a lot of conflicts that had to be resolved.
I should just mention at this point, Cowell knew radio. He actually hosted some live radio concerts on WNYC back in the 1940s, which
oh,
we
but
had
he
in our
started
archives.
Hosting live concerts on WEVD in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. We don't have those in our library, though.
We don't have WEVD.
No, we don't.
No.
Well, let's hear a little bit of this piece, Homage to Iran, from the American composer Henry Cowell. That's just a little bit of Homage to Iran, one of several works by the American composer Henry Cowell that he did in the 50s when he had spent some time in Iran, as told in my guest Joel Sachs's book, Henry Cowell, A Man Made of Music. Cowell, a major figure, a huge inspiration for a lot of the other major figures in 20th century American classical music. Now, let's talk a bit about 4 years in San Quentin prison.
Could I, before we do that, just interject one thing about your last statement, which is that people also don't realize that through the 1920s and much of the early 1930s, before European governments began to move toward totalitarianism, Cowell was probably the best known American composer in Europe because he played so much all over Europe. He was the first American invited to perform in the Soviet Union, which is a story that's too long for this show, mm-hmm. but I'll have to read this in the book. And so he was really incredibly famous.
Right, right. Then comes the 4 years in prison, And the story, as I've heard it over the years, is that this changes everything. It changes him as a person. It changes him as a composer. Tell us what you found about that story.
Well, I don't believe it changed him as a composer at all, except that he had to begin thinking in prison of practicality, because he worked with the prison band, whose conductor was a violinist and apparently the ranking murderer in the prison, and protected him from sexual assault.
Mm-hmm. And he was in on a morals charge, so he
exactly.
would have been...
would have been very likely that it would be attempted rape.
Why was he there?
Well, he was accused of a single act of oral sex with a young adult, a 17-year-old, which was adult at that time, and he made the absolutely stupid mistake of pleading guilty to it. I say he made the stupid mistake because the district attorney said he made a stupid mistake. And there was tremendous publicity. The Hearst newspapers made it a banner headline, front page story. Another newspaper went to him and said, we'll do public relations for you. And he didn't recognize a blackmail attempt. So they ran a series of six unbelievably horrible articles suggesting that the Cowell family be the victim of vigilantes and so forth. So when the hearing came up, the interesting thing about this law is that it has nothing to do with homosexuality at all. In fact, the original version of it was clearly not meant to be homosexual or heterosexual, but any oral sex. And it mandated an indeterminate sentence of 1 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. So at the hearing, it quickly turned into the question of whether he was a dangerous homosexual, although that had nothing to do with the law. And several prominent psychiatrists, including a leading prison psychiatrist, said, no, he is not a dangerous man. However, there had been an incident about 14 years earlier, and the probation officer reported on it, although he did not report all of it, which is that it hadn't been considered an important incident. The family said, forget it, you know, we're not going to even think about prosecution. And as a result, the judge said, I don't really have a choice. I have to sentence him. So he went to jail. He went to San Quentin. At the end of the first year, the Board of Prison Terms and Paroles had to determine the final sentence. And they were very reactionary, and there had also been some true sex crimes. So they sentenced him to 15 years in San Quentin.
Of which he served four.
He finally got a parole after four, and probably only because in the 1938 election, a Democrat was elected to the governorship of California, who learned about the scandalous conditions in the penal system and replaced the prison board. And then the new people felt he was fine. He was not a bad risk.
So Henry Cowell, at the height of his fame and, you know, at a kind of a point where his musical style has matured, is now spending 4 years in prison. And as you write, he's keeping busy. You know, he's had contact with, you know, other musicians and publishers, and he's got the musicians there in the prison.
It should be added that he was always an educator. Cage had already studied with him before the prison term, but in San Quentin, he taught music to 2,700 prisoners.
Wow.
And that may be why, according to some federal survey that I ran into, San Quentin had the largest participation in adult education programs in those years of any state prison in the United States.
Wow. Well, you know, wherever he went, it seems people flocked to him to learn and to find out, you know, what he was about. I mean, Henry Cowell was an amazing figure. The hymns and fuguing tunes are probably some of his best-known works.
Yeah, they tend to get played more.
Yeah, those are post-prison.
Yes. In fact, he started writing these so-called hymns and fuguing tunes after his wife, Sidney Robertson Cowell, who was a noted folklorist who worked with Alan Lomax. She pointed him towards some collections of early American harmonizations of songs and church tunes.
And when you say early American, you mean like revolutionary period.
Yeah, 18th century.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the Hymn and Fuguing Tune number 2, arguably Henry Cowell's most famous piece.
Thank you.
some of the hymn and fuguing tune number 2 by Henry Cowell. He is the topic of Joel Sachs's book, Henry Cowell, A Man Made of Music. Joel Sachs, author, pianist, conductor, professor at the Juilliard School. He directs the new Juilliard Ensemble and the new music group Continuum. And Joel, it's a, as you said before, if you made this guy up, Hollywood wouldn't be buying it. But no. Every word of it is true, and it's a fascinating story.
But unfortunately, what Hollywood would buy is the prison story, and that's the sad part. Yeah. It's like Gesualdo having murdered his wife and her lover. That's what people remember of him, and that's too bad.
Yeah. Well, Joel, thank you very much for telling us a bit of the story of Henry Cowell.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
This is Soundcheck.